Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week, Salt Lake County DA Sim Gill says the shooting death of a young Salt Lake City man by a police officer is justified, even though he didn't have a gun. We'll talk how body cams and profiling and Utah's open carry law figure into the Dylan Taylor case. Candidates clashed over the fight against Utah's ban on same-sex marriage. We'll hear more about the debate between incumbent Attorney General Sean Reyes and his Democratic challenger, Charles Stormont. And the state says coal-fired power plants don't need to cut emissions. We'll find out what environmentalists think about the recent decision. All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and today on the program we've got police shootings, air quality, politics, and much more. And joining me this morning, Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is here. George, good morning.
Good morning.
Also on the reporting side, Justice reporter Aaron Alberti is here. Aaron, good morning.
Hi.
And environment reporter Brian Maffley is in the studio. Brian, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be back.
And you can join us too. If there's a story on your mind, you can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put your comments at the website sltrib.com. You can also call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Aaron Alberti, I want to start with you. This officer-involved shooting of Dylan Taylor. This week, Salt Lake County DA Sim Gill said that the shooting was justified. Now, before we get to that decision, can you give us some background? What happened? What were the circumstances surrounding the Taylor shooting?
Well, Dylan Taylor was walking with his cousin and his brother in the area of 2100 South and State Street, where there's a 7-Eleven. While they were walking in the neighborhood, a 911 caller reported that she'd seen them. She described their clothing and said that they were flashing a gun, said that they looked suspicious, that they looked like they were looking for trouble, gangbangers. So the police went to that area, and they saw the three guys matching that description walking into the 7-Eleven. When they came out, the police started to approach them. Dylan Taylor walked away. The cousin and the brother held up their hands and faced police. Dylan Taylor walked away. The officer followed him. There was some commands shouted. Dylan Taylor put his hands in his pants and then turned around, said something to the officer who had his gun raised at this point. And then when he did something with his hands, you can see his shirt lifting up, and then he was shot by the officer. Hmm. You can see it in a video.
Well, I mean, that is something that's really unique about this case. Gill released video of the body cam that the officer who shot Taylor was wearing. For those who haven't seen it, could you describe what we saw in that video?
Well, kind of what I just told you. And so Salt Lake City Police had said a long time ago that they would release this video, and they did release it in its entirety this week. The video shows the officer, you know, getting out of the car. His name is Officer Braun Cruz with Salt Lake City Police, approaching the guys. There are two backup officers with him. You can see one of them kind of in the video. But he follows Dylan Taylor kind of along the front of the 7-Eleven. When the audio turns on, you can hear him yelling, "Get your hands out, get your hands out, get out your hands." Dylan Taylor then, you can see, first he doesn't have his hands in his pants, but then he does. Hmm. And then he turns around and, you know, he's kind of up to his wrists in his pants. The officer is yelling at him to get him out, and he says something. Now, the DA's office, Sim Gill, said that it was interpreted as "no fool" or "nah fool." I mean, to be honest, I've watched the video probably a dozen times at this point. I can't make out what it is he says. Hmm. And I don't know what kind of listening technology they may have to hear it. I'm watching just the raw video. So he says something, and then then the thing happens with the shirt and the hands kind of coming up, and that's when he's shot.
Hmm. Police were on the scene because of a 911 call. You've listened to that 911 call?
I've read the transcript of it.
Okay, so what were the police responding to?
The woman calls and says that immediately that she says it's a group of gangbangers that are flashing a gun. The 911 caller asks, you know, so you said they're flashing the gun. Have they threatened anybody with it?
The dispatcher.
The dispatcher is asking what they're doing with the gun and where is the gun. She says it's in the pocket or waistband. And she says, no, they're not threatening it. She says, but they're looking for trouble just the way they look, is what she says. And describes their clothing.
Okay.
And where they're walking.
I suppose that would be a typical kind of 911 call. You see something suspicious, you call the police. But what was being reported was not illegal under Utah law, right? I mean, you can go and carry a gun openly and it's perfectly fine.
Yeah. I mean, as long as you are not restricted from carrying a firearm, and as long as you're not doing anything illegal with it. And I asked the police about that, you know, when somebody calls and reports something that's not, you know, apparently illegal. The deputy chief over investigations told me that, you know, we have an obligation to investigate. If somebody makes a call, if we go and we find that there is nothing, then that's the end of the investigation. There's nothing more to do. He said that in the case of Dylan Taylor, they never got to that point because the situation got worse, you know, once the officers got there with Dylan Taylor's not following the commands. Now, the family of Dylan Taylor, the people that were with him, have said that he had headphones on, which you can see in the video, that he was listening to music and he couldn't hear the commands that were being issued to him, and that's why he didn't follow them. Gil has said that when he turns around, he obviously can see Officer Cruz pointing a gun and yelling at him. So at that point, you know, he has, you know, the thought in the officer's mind reportedly was, why wasn't he responding?
Hmm. All of this within the context of the national conversation, George, that we've been having, what's happened in Ferguson, officer-involved shootings becoming more high profile. I mean, what do you make of all this?
Well, to some degree, it's unfortunate coincidence. We had what happened in Ferguson. We had the incident of
the other young man shot who was apparently carrying a sword, which may or may not have been a toy or a prop. And then we had this incident, which the district attorney ruled on the other day. I mean, part of it gets down, in this particular case, part of it gets down to just the way we talk. I mean, he ruled that the shooting was justified. Well, it's kind of like when people say that somebody was found innocent. Well, they weren't really found innocent. They were found not guilty. They were found that there wasn't enough evidence to convict. In this case, you know, you could argue whether the shooting was justified, because that's almost a matter of opinion, but legally the shooting was not unjustified. It was not illegal. It was not a crime, in the opinion of the district attorney, and he has the video that's on the officer to back him up. More and more, I think we're going to see more and more policemen, individuals, and police departments in states and cities buying these body cams. It really seemed to be dispositive in this case. There's always a risk, though. I mean, we get really dependent on technology, and anybody who's tried to find a Wi-Fi site or tried to download a video or can understand that this isn't always 100% correct. We get used to watching Star Trek, where they have three-dimensional images of videos of and records of everything that happened. You know, this video is not exactly a Hollywood movie. It moves around and it's kind of hard to hear. And as she said, it was. Some people think they know what the individual said to the officer. Other people listen to it a dozen times, and all they hear is garble. Mm-hmm. So even these are subject to interpretation and subject to subjective ideas about what's happening.
With your sources, Aaron, I mean, are police going to rely on technology? I mean, is this sort of a turning point, and police departments and officers say this can really help us?
Pretty much everyone wants the body cams, it sounds like. I mean, having talked to several police departments about this, I know that lots of police departments are in the process of testing out some models. And definitely criminal defense lawyers are seeking. The Utah Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers is in the process of researching proposals for legislation to require it on all police officers. So yeah, even in UPD, for example, their spokesman told me that some of their officers have gone out and just bought them with their own money because they want them. And, you know, like you said, it's not always perfect. I mean, in this case, not only do you have this sort of garbled response in the case of Dylan Taylor, the kind of the critical moment where the shirt goes up, you can't see his other hand in the video because it's being obstructed by the gun that the officer is holding. Mm. It's a chest clipped body camera, I think, or at least wherever it is on his body, it's obstructed by actually, I think it may be glasses. It's obstructed.
So we're not actually seeing what the officer is seeing?
Well, you can see most of what the officer is seeing. Unfortunately, you can't see a pretty critical point, which is,
sure,
you know, the officer has said he made a drawing motion with the hand you can't see, as if he's about to draw a gun. And that's something you can't see. Also, I didn't want to, like, I was concerned that I may have overstated the duration of time that he was not following commands after he turned around. Just earlier I said that. And, I mean, it is a brief, the whole thing takes just a couple seconds.
Wow.
So, you know, that's why the attorney for his family saying that it went too fast, and saying that it went too fast because the officer was basically prejudiced against Dylan Taylor.
His family is not happy.
No.
And they've organized a rally?
Well, the rally had been organized previously. They're going to be there. They're going to be speaking. And there's a lot of interest in it. A lot of the families of people who have been shot by police are going to be there. The mother of Danielle Willard is in town for a hearing next week, the preliminary hearing.
She was shot
hearing.
And killed by a West Valley police officer.
Yeah,
about
Dan,
a year, 2012.
2012. Yeah, in November of 2012, the officer that killed her is no longer with the department, and he's been charged with manslaughter. His preliminary hearing is next week, so her mother is going to be in town, and she's going to be speaking at the rally on Saturday. I know that family members of Darian Hunt in Saratoga Springs, the sword incident that you mentioned, he was killed in September, in a police shooting. So there, I think that the supporters of Geist, the dog, are going to be there. So it's, yeah, there's going to be quite a few people covering a lot of different officer-involved shootings that have happened in the last couple of years.
Yeah. Brian, do you have something?
I have a question for Aaron. Maybe you could describe the technology that goes into the body cams and how the officers use them. And one of the concerns I thought people might have, or the officers might have, is aren't they a distraction, you know, to activate them and to put them on and all that?
Well, different models are used in different ways. I know in Ogden they're testing out several models, and they had tried some that are like attached to little kind of glasses fixtures, and they didn't like that. One of their lieutenants said that the testers did not, they thought that was distracting, they thought that got in their way. They wanted to do the chest cams ones, that was more comfortable for them, but the chest cams, it was harder to keep it on what they're looking at, you know? So if they've got their head facing one way and their chest facing the other way because their head is turned, then the camera won't pick up what they're actually seeing. Also, it's more easily obstructed when it's down there, you know, particularly in a shooting. If you've got a thing at your chest and you're holding a gun at, you know, the level of your abdomen or chest, then it's not going to see anything because you're going to be in its way. So different cameras, you know, have different pluses and minuses. And apparently in Saratoga Springs, they are also testing out different cameras. They had some problems with theirs. They had gotten a few with some grant funding, and sometimes the audio would cut out, sometimes the video would cut out. They weren't that pleased with them. And it would appear that the officers in the shooting of Darian Hunt weren't wearing them, or if they did, they weren't on. They're in a sort of transitional phase and introductory phase of getting their officers body cammed.
Yeah. Well, at what point in a, you know, interaction with a suspicious person does the officer activate the camera?
My understanding is they want them to activate it basically as soon as they know that, you know, it's going to start. Now, the camera is programmed to pick up 30 seconds of footage before it's activated. So it's kind of got like a rolling recording mechanism that will start saving at 30 seconds beforehand. And that's so, like, for example, if there's a traffic stop and the motorist is driving erratically, and then when the officer sees it and decides to stop them, they will actually have the what they were seeing that prompted them to stop the motorist on film, because they didn't know they were going to stop the motorist when that was actually happening. Now, in the case of Dylan Taylor's shooting, the officer turns it on kind of after he's first approached everybody. And so I know that the deputy chief said that it's possible the shooting will be reviewed by internal affairs and their training unit, which are, they're under the same unit totally, but they do kind of different things. Internal affairs investigates for policy violations and protocol violations, whereas the training unit reviews for just kind of things that could be done better that maybe they need to do more training on. So, you know, he said this may result in more training about, no, it's got to become kind of a reflex when you get out of the car to activate it. It's activated manually. And his backup officer, Officer Cruz's backup officer, he tried and apparently couldn't get it started at all. And you can hear on the video from Cruz's body cam when the officer, the backup officer, right after the shooting, pretty much the first thing he addresses is, I couldn't get the camera to work. I couldn't get it to turn on. Did you get yours to turn on? So that's like an immediate, like, urgent point of interest as this, you know, pretty dramatic incident is unfolding.
Well, technology and, you know, body cams and officer-involved shootings, all of this is going to keep you very busy for some time. You're going to the rally tomorrow?
I'm going to try to, yeah.
Okay. Erin Alberti, you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us, too. The number, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. And joining me today, reporters Erin Alberti, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke is here as well. We also have editorial writer George Pyle, all from the Salt Lake Tribune. And we're talking about this week's top stories. And if you've got something to say, send it to the tweet, to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter. You can also put comments at sltrib.com or call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. Brian, let's turn to air quality. A ton of air quality news this week. Maybe you can start with the Clean Air Action Plan submitted by a group of advisors to the governor. What did they say in their proposal?
Yeah, that's right. For a little context, about exactly a year ago, Governor Herbert impaneled 38 people from all sorts of backgrounds, public health, industry, environmental advocates, to come up with some action plan items recommendations for addressing air quality issues in our valley here. On a day like today, or, you know, like in the last week or so, it's easy to forget that sometimes the air quality in our valley gets really, really bad. So they came out with, I think their main objective was to have a consensus approach. They wanted to recommend things that everybody could agree on this panel. So that's going to kind of, you know, lower the bar somewhat. And they also wanted them to be not too painful. So you wind up with several recommendations that are really low-hanging fruit. Some of them are really at mouth level. And the key things they wanted to focus on is how to get clean up the emissions from our automobiles. We kind of famously now all seem to know that half our air quality problem in the Salt Lake Valley can be attributed to emissions from automobiles. I don't know if everyone agrees with that, but there seems to be a lot of opinion in that direction. So their big recommendation is, let's get these Tier 3 automobiles and Tier 3 gasolines available in Salt Lake sooner rather than later. The sooner we start replacing our automobile fleet with these cleaner vehicles, with access to cleaner gasoline, that'll have a huge, huge impact on the air quality. They thought in the next 15 years or so, once we've accomplished this transition, we'll have, you know, reduced by 60% the mobile emissions. The other ones that really kind of stood out for me were recommendations were, let's eliminate wood burning on inversion days. That seems like, why would that be a big deal? There's not that many people burning wood in our valley, and it can't be that big of a contributor. But the science seems to suggest that it plays a disproportionate role in how bad the air quality gets. But, you know, there's a lot of people. We think 200 to 300 at least in Salt Lake City and neighboring communities where wood stoves are the only source of heat. And it seems grossly unfair to those people who are probably people without a lot of financial means to make the investment to, you know, to put a furnace in their house and then, you know, have to pay a utility bill. You know, these are things the rest of us have done. So, you know, there's that. And then there's a few other things that I had never thought of, replacing water heaters with ultra-low NOx-emitting water heaters. So one of their recommendations was to require all the stores that sell these appliances to only sell those that meet these rigorous standards for low emissions. You know, there might be some pushback from some people who might think that that's intruding on the free market system.
So you got this laundry list of low-hanging fruit, I guess, yeah, where people can commonly agree. I assume environmentalists that you talk to like this plan.
Absolutely. There's hardly anything to argue that these aren't good ideas. Whether, you know, they'll actually be implemented, that remains to be seen.
Mm. But one decision they don't like is one that state regulators made this week when it comes to setting standards for coal-fired power plants. What was that decision that came down?
Oh, you're talking about the Division of Air Quality.
Yes.
There's a little background on that. Under the Clean Air Act, the states have to implement what they're calling regional haze plans to address the emissions from power plants that mar the vistas over what we call Class 1 airsheds. And those are 156 wilderness areas and national parks. We have five of these such airsheds, and the visibility there aren't meeting expectations. So a decade ago or so, they came up with the Division of Air Quality came up with a plan for some of Utah's older coal-fired power plants that required substantial upgrades at Rocky Mountain Power's Hunter and Huntington plants. Very big plants, burn a lot of coal in Emery County. A few years after that, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency said, you know, your analysis isn't up to snuff. We want you to go back and redo part of the plan. Not the whole thing, just this part having to do with best available reasonable technology. The acronym is BART. I think that's what it stands for. In the meantime, Utah sued over that. They did not prevail. They have now since come forward with a new plan that says, hey, everything is okay. We're not going to require Rocky Mountain Power to do anything more with those two power plants. They have, and this is very, the environmental community is very unhappy about that. Four groups got together and fired off this salvo at the Department of Environmental Quality, calling it a do-nothing plan, quote-unquote.
Is this a plan that the EPA has to approve?
Exactly. The EPA ultimately gets to the power to sign off on it. Until then, though, there's a public comment period on this plan that lasts for 30 days. I'm not sure when that 30 days are up. And then it has to get submitted to the EPA by January, I believe. And they'll get to give it the thumbs up or thumbs down. Now, the state's rationale here, is a good one. Rocky Mountain Power has invested almost $600 million in upgrading those two plants and installing low NOx burners, kind of like the hot water heaters we just talked about. And the reductions in emissions for nitrous oxides, coupled with other upgrades to get rid of sulfur dioxide, have been pretty good. Tens of thousands of tons of emissions have been prevented because of these upgrades. And as Colleen Delaney, an environmental scientist with the DAQ, kind of testified the other day that, gee, we've asked them to do these upgrades. The emissions are lower, and hey, the air quality, or the visibility over these Class 1's air sheds haven't improved all that much. In some cases, haven't improved at all. So, you know, we have now the environmental community would like these plants to install equipment known as selective catalytic reduction, known as SCR. Sorry, I always get that one mixed up. That would cost $673 million to install at those two plants, and according to the division, would reduce nitrogen oxide emissions by 80%. That's a substantial reduction, but they believe that the cost is too high to justify considering the uncertainty of the benefits. So that's where things stand. There's going to be a lot more to say on this.
And how long is the public comment period?
It's for 30 days.
30 days.
I believe that the comment period doesn't start till the 1st of November, but I'm not sure. But there's a plenty big window for people to comment.
Okay. You had another story, yet another air quality story this week.
Yeah, there's no end to it.
An ozone study in the Uinta Basin. So what were researchers looking for? What did they find?
Well, the Uinta Basin is a air quality mystery. It's in wintertime, their ozone levels get so high that they rival those of big polluted cities like LA, where you have millions of people and millions of cars in a basin, not much bigger than the Uinta Basin. So the ozone problems normally occur in the summer when you have lots of sunlight. Sunlight spurs the chemical reactions that create ozone from other pollution. So the problem in the Uinta Basin is the volatile organic compound emissions associated with oil and gas production is kind of laying the foundation for a lot of ozone pollution that however, it spikes in the wintertime when there's not a lot of sun. So the scientific community has taken a huge interest in the Uinta Basin. It's kind of a laboratory, a natural laboratory for trying to figure out how ozone forms and what the role of various meteorological conditions in its formation. So the NOAA, the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration, am I saying that right? National? Anyway, NOAA, as we affectionately call it, has invested a lot of scientific resources in studying this problem in partnership with Utah Department of Environmental Quality, I might add, gathering data. And one of the things they've learned in this study they published this week was that the cold weather and a lot of snow cover means more ozone formation. In this study, they kind of figure out that photochemistry of what's going on to kind of promote the formation of ozone, which is an oxygen molecule with three atoms. Normally, we like oxygen in molecules of two atoms. When you have that third atom in there, it becomes highly corrosive and it eats up your lungs and your the rubber in your tires. I mean, it's really damaging stuff. So what they found was, well, when you have cold, inverted weather in the basin in the winter, it presses all that pollution from the oil and gas industry down near the ground, so it's more concentrated. And then when you have snow cover, the sunlight comes in at a steep angle, bounces off the snow, back up through the pollution, and it just makes these reactions happen that much faster. So
it's all bad news for us, right?
Well,
for those who live there.
It is bad news, and it could potentially be bad news for the oil and gas industry if the EPA, as is expected, really, in the coming years to declare the Uinta Basin out of attainment for the ozone standard. And that's, first of all, it's going to probably happen because there's high ozone there, but the EPA is also next year expected to reduce the federal threshold is standard from the current 75 parts per billion to between 60 and 70 parts per billion. It's unlikely, under today's emission levels in the Uinta Basin, that the Uinta Basin will remain in attainment for ozone.
Well, I mean, the air quality is a top issue for so many people. If you want more detail, go online, sltrib.com. Take a look at Brian's coverage this week. It's been stellar. We got to move on. We got to move on to politics, because that's a huge thing as we march toward Election Day. And Robert Gerke is here. Another election 2014 debate happened this week.
Right.
This time between the two major party candidates for AG, Attorney General. What happened?
Well, I think both of them kind of came out wanting to show that they were the guy who could clean up the office. Obviously, on the heels of the Swallow and Shurtleff scandal, they kind of wanted to make their statement. Sean Reyes, who's been in there for 9 months now, interestingly, almost as long as John Swallow was in office, but he's been in there for 9 months, and he laid out the changes that he's put in place. He says morale is on the rebound there. They're getting better reviews from the state agencies that they serve, and that things are on the right track. Charles Stormont, who's a Democrat, kind of came out swinging and said that, you know, nothing has changed structurally in the office. I mean, he's moved some of the deck chairs around, but there's still sort of these sort of structural problems where you have everything coming through the Attorney General's office. There's still the potential there that for exactly what happened with the Swallow and Shurtleff saga. So he says more needs to be done, and he's the guy to do it. That was sort of one of the key things they disputed, or they went back and forth on. There was also sort of this interesting philosophical disagreement between the two, where Sean, and it sort of revolves around Amendment 3, the same-sex marriage ban, and Sean Reyes said he has a obligation to defend the law, whether he agrees with it or not, whether he thinks it's constitutional or not. Stormont says that's a waste of money. It's a law that's going to be struck down by the courts. It's lost in 40 courts around the country, you know, in over the past year. And he says it would be better off to walk away from that case. If the governor wants to hire an attorney to defend it, you know, he can do that. But the Attorney General's office should walk away from it and put the money into things like child protection services. And so it kind of got to a really fundamental disagreement, not just on, say, Amendment 3, but also on polygamy cases, on the same-sex adoption cases and things like that, where, you know, what is the Attorney General's obligation to defend the law? So that was an interesting contrast between the two as well.
The Attorney General's office has been the focus, well, of your life for I don't know how many months, but
yeah.
It's interesting to me that this is going to be the only matchup that we're going to see between these two. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of it's a little ironic, I guess, that we've kind of with these structured debates now, we don't have multiple debates like we used to have. It used to be there, you know, each TV station or, you know, the radio station or whatever would sponsor a debate. This is likely going to be the only one between the Attorney General candidates. Sean Reyes has said he's got a busy schedule. He said this one debate is online. Anybody anywhere can watch it, you know, whenever they want. And, you know, he thinks it covered the topics, I guess. Interestingly, they didn't talk at all about public lands. They didn't really, you know, there were some issues that were sort of not discussed at all. But, you know, Charles Stormont, the Democrat, and usually the challenger wants more debates, and it's not an exception. Charles Stormont said he would love to have more debates and more appearances, but it just doesn't appear likely that that's going to happen.
George, is that a good thing? Fewer debates or not?
Well, I think the point Robert made about how this is online. You can go look at it anytime you want. It's not like the original Nixon-Kennedy debate where if you missed it, you missed it.
Right.
And all you knew was what the other guy at the next desk said the next day at work. And they're making other appearances. Generally, though, you know, more information to the public is better, especially when you have a challenger who, at least in my opinion, is a legitimate, qualified challenger. And the people ought to be able to look at both candidates and hear them out and make up their own minds. Now, I watch.
Sometimes people stick to their talking points, but sometimes they don't.
Well, sometimes they don't. I mean, you know, the Kinsleyan gaffe is when a politician says what he really thinks. I watched the debate. Afterwards, my wife said, who won the debate? And I said, whoever you already agreed with. And because both of them made their points, and both of them stuck to their, you could say, talking points, but they are important issues, especially the issue of what's the role of an attorney general? Is he supposed to defend the laws of Utah as passed by the legislature, whether they're good ideas or not? Or is he supposed to be, because he's an independently elected official, not he doesn't appointed by the governor, he doesn't he's not a creature of the legislature, is he supposed to do as Charles Stormont says, which is to be the lawyer who looks the client in the eye and says, you got nothing, and you're wasting your money and you're wasting your time, or whether he's supposed to be even more independent than that, and as a representative of all the people of Utah, make a choice and say, it's not just that I disagree with this law, it's not just a matter of policy, it's unconstitutional. And as an officer of the court, I'm not going to try and defend it. Attorneys general in Nevada and Oregon and Virginia have made just that decision with their same-sex bans. And it also gets into the question of public lands, which didn't come up at the debate, but when both candidates were in to see the editorial board, we discussed that issue. And again, the incumbent, Sean Reyes, is much more likely to do what the legislature wants, to fight for 2477 roads, to fight for the supposed return of land that Utah never owned, because the legislature says so. And Stormont is saying those are bad cases. Those are bad law. It's a waste of the taxpayers' money. It makes us look bad. And if you want to go negotiate with the federal government for, you know, land usage and land ownership that the state of Utah might like, this doesn't help you. It just makes you look foolish.
We've been talking about the attorney general's race, but those who came before, Sean Reyes and Charles Stormont,
they're still with us.
The trial against former AGs John Swallow and Mark Shurliff continues to chug along. This week, we found out a bit more about the scope of those who may be called to be witnesses in the cases. What did we find out?
Yeah, the county attorney who's prosecuting the case, in response to a motion by Attorney General Shurtleff, former Attorney General Shurtleff, released a list of 56 potential witnesses that they could call at the preliminary hearing, which is a pretty extensive list. But, and it had the people you would expect if you've been following the saga. It had the Jeremy Johnsons and Mark Jensens, Kirk Torgensen, who was one of the top aides to Attorney General Shurtleff. It had some other interesting names, too. One of the names that jumped out at me, actually, was Jim Mintz, who was the investigator who was hired by the House committee to investigate the Swallow saga. So 56 names of potential witnesses. That doesn't mean they're all going to be called. And it sort of gave us an idea, I guess, of the direction that they're expecting this to go, and probably the scope of the preliminary hearing as well. Mm. This was all in response to former Attorney General Shurtleff seeking more particular information, more expansive information, I guess, on the investigation that went into these charges. The state has provided some. It's objecting to others, and we're kind of waiting for this to play through before we get to the preliminary hearing.
And Shurtleff made another appearance outside of court this week. What happened at the DABC, the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control?
Right. It wasn't actually. Mark is going into launching this business venture with his brother. They're going to make these little inhalers, I guess, and one of them would have caffeine in it, and one would have sort of an anti-smoking thing. And they're just little puff inhalers like, you know, kids with asthma use. But one of the propellants in it is ethanol-based, and so because the state regulates alcohol, including ethanol, they have to get a special use permit for these things. So it was kind of unusual, I guess, unexpected maybe, for him to be appearing there, but that's one of the things he's up to these days.
An interesting cameo, George, right?
Well, guy's got to make a living. He can't be attorney general anymore, and I doubt if anybody but his brother is probably in the market to hire either of these gentlemen as their attorney, and they've got a lot of bills to pay. So yeah, they're looking for something to do, but I would imagine it was a little surprising when he wandered in and said, I appear on behalf of.
Right. Another political tidbit, Mitt Romney making local headlines for a couple of things this week. First, his residency. I guess he's moving.
Yeah. They've been building this house up, I don't know if I should say exactly, well, it's up on Walker Lane, for quite a while now. They the family kind of bought, I guess, two plots up there, and is kind of and has been working on this for quite some time. And so it looks like he's making it his official residence. He's going to spend some time with the grandkids, I guess. And then the other one that was kind of you know, gave people a chuckle, I guess, was that I guess his voter registration was had errors on it, which was, you know, when you're the guy who could have been president, I guess, you want to get your voter registration in order. It apparently wasn't his fault, and they've corrected it, and it was just sort of a snafu.
Blame the clerks.
Blame the clerks.
That's where you go when that happens. Obviously, still in the news nationally, he's giving stump speeches for candidates. George, what's your gut? Is he making a third run for the White House in 2016?
Well, I'm not very good at these predictions, but there are a lot of people who are following every step, and that's why, you know, the voter registration was kind of interesting, because
he registered as an independent.
Well, yeah. Well, he says he didn't, and the clerk apparently, yeah, I blame the clerk. But again, it's almost like, well, if you can't get your voter registration right, you know, how are you going to decide who to launch cruise missiles at? But apparently it wasn't his fault. But yeah, I mean, if he really meant, which he didn't, but if he really meant to register unaffiliated, you know, that would send huge shockwaves through the whole thing. Well, obviously, he's not going to run for president again if he's not even going to be a Republican anymore. Well, that's not what happened, so that's not there. And, you know, your official residence, does that make a whole lot of difference politically? I mean, it's not like Utah's a swing state and he would move here in order to make sure he won Utah. He'd win Utah anyway. At the same time, you know, John Huntsman is out there leading the No Labels campaign, and there are burbles out there that he might run for president again as an independent, as an unaffiliated, because he leads this group that's basically saying a pox on both your houses to both the Republicans and the Democrats. Mm.
Robert, what are the political insiders saying or thinking about all of this?
You know, it's a fun parlor game for people to think that Mitt Romney's going to run again, but he's said he's done everything but slam and lock the door on the potential. But there, you know, then his wife Kate did an interview and said, you know, we'll just have to see or something like that. You know, most of everything I've read from those who are close to him, you know, say it's very unlikely he's going to run, but they're leaving that small window of opportunity, I guess, if he wants to make a third run, which would be pretty extraordinary. I thinking back in recent history, I can't think of anybody outside of maybe Lyndon LaRouche who's run that many times for president. But, you know, I personally think it's pretty unlikely, but I think people who are Romney supporters love to have that, you know, that glimmer of hope out there that he could come back and make one more return.
The speculation continues. We're talking about the week's news. We invite you to join us, 801-355-TALK. Put your comments at sltrib.com. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. In studio with me, Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, Aaron Alberti, and George Pyle. And you can join us at 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Time for our In Case You Missed It story or underplayed story of the week. George, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, in with all the politicking and debating and campaigning going on, a lot of stuff may be a little bit under the radar. The thing that I think is we ought to be paying attention to is what they call the Intergenerational Poverty Report from the Department of Workforce Services. Senator Stuart Reed, a Republican from Ogden, no shining liberal, he has been pushing the legislature through his entire term to take a look at what causes poverty to stick with a family through various generations. And where can the state logically and efficiently step in and stop it from going to the next generation? Now, he has to spend three-quarters of his time convincing people that this is not liberal, not even progressive, that it's efficient, that it's conservative, that you're helping families, that over the long run you're saving money because money you spend on child nutrition and guidance and counseling, you don't spend on remedial ed, you don't spend on jails, you don't spend on prisons, you don't spend on police. So you save a lot of money down the line, even if you don't have a bleeding heart and care about these little poor children. Taxpayers are going to save a ton. And they're starting pilot projects in Ogden and in other places where you have the one-stop shopping. People can come in and say, look, you know, we need help. They make sure the kids go to school. They make sure the kids have breakfast. They make sure the kids get their immunizations. They help people with everything from resume writing to just basic social skills that are the kinds of things that if you don't have, you stay poor.
Can he get others on the bandwagon?
Well, he's gotten the legislature on the bandwagon to fund these studies, to fund these pilot programs. He's leaving the legislature after one term, and so somebody's going to have to pick up this torch and run with it. But the Department of Workforce Services apparently is totally on board, and they really think they've got something that will have serious long-term benefits. And it's a way for them to say, look, this is the Utah way of doing it. This is not being forced on us by the federal government or the bureaucrats. We're doing it here. The local bureaucrats think that there's a lot of promise in this. There seems to be a lot of legislative buy-in. So this really could make a big difference in a lot of people's lives and to the taxpayers.
Not very often we get to highlight a feel-good story. Yes. Thank you, George. Aaron Alberti, what do you got?
Well, in Paul Raleigh's latest column, at the very bottom of the column, he discusses the outcome of a trademark case that has been going on between the LDS Church and the owner of a Mormon singles dating site called Mormon Match. The church had filed trademark objections to the use of the word Mormon in the name of the website. In federal court, the Electronic Frontier Foundation got involved, saying, hey, to restrict the use of the word Mormon would be like Taco Bell having a claim on the word taco, and that shouldn't happen. Ultimately, the owner of the site, Jonathan Eller, he was in Texas, I think, changed the name of the site to Latter Date.
Latter Date.
And that is how that's how this all shook out. So I don't know, maybe it's a cuter name. Maybe, I don't know if everyone's going to know that it's LDS, but, you know, hopefully. So there you go.
That's a great
story. If you want a
date,
go to Latter Date.
Latter Date. Okay, Brian, what's your in case you missed it story?
Well, now I have a great name for the taco stand I want to down here at the library. I thought this study that the Utah Rivers Council put out this week was really interesting. It was really fun to read. What they were drawing attention to is the odd way water is priced to consumers in Utah. They have this, led by Zach Frankel, one of Utah's more colorful activists. They've long argued that in Utah, water is priced too low. As a result, we use too much. And as another result of that, we are running out of water, allegedly, and the state of Utah has a list that is $32 billion long now of upgrading existing water infrastructure and building new projects, the biggest of which are the Lake Powell Pipeline, completing the Central Utah Project, and the Bear River Water Development Project. Of course, environmentalists would like to see those not get built so that the water will stay in the rivers where they can sustain ecosystems. However, you know, there's many people in our state who feel that, you know, Utah is letting 300,000 acre feet of its share of the Colorado River go bye-bye down the across the border into Arizona, and that's water we should be using to sustain our economy.
So all of this is tied to water pricing. The price of water will regulate how much people use.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Brian. I'm going to have to move on.
Okay.
Read the story, sltrip.com. Yes. Robert, very quick.
Yeah. So I'm actually going to tease something that's going to happen next week. It's not going to be underplayed, I don't think, but it would probably be pretty big news. But the state school board is going to interview candidates for the superintendent position on October 9th. They'll announce the names of the four finalists on October 6th. And you know, we'll find out who's in the running for that.
And that's related to my underplayed story. Breck England, who sued to get on the ballot as a candidate in the state school board race, he withdrew this week, throwing his support behind someone else. Very interesting. Robert Gerke, Aaron Alberti, Brian Maffley, and George Pyle, thank you very much.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too. We'll wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week, in honor of election season, he's talking about it's time to elect a woman as president.
I didn't necessarily say Hillary, but I think it's time for a woman president. I mean, a series of men have brought this country to where it is today. Isn't it about time we tried the game from the other side of the gender? I mean, really. If you're upset about the way America is today and the way things are going, blame men. We're the ones who've been in charge. So, yeah, it's time for a woman president. And I wrote a column about it explaining why I thought it was time and the benefits that would come as a result of it.
This is back in 1998?
1998, right. There was a survey conducted by the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center that claimed at the time in 97 that there was an increasingly better chance that a woman would occupy the White House in the next 10 years. Well, it didn't happen.
No.
But that doesn't mean it still can't. And in a column I wrote about it, I said I could vote for a woman, not just any woman, mind you. It would have to be the right woman. That means a female candidate willing to guarantee three things. Thing one, no increase in taxes. Thing two, force welfare recipients to work. Thing three, the U.S. Army's dress uniform will not change to resemble that worn by the Greek Army. No offense, but puffy skirts, silk tights, and tasseled shoes make it damn hard to jump out of airplanes, storm beaches, and pick up trash. Nobody, including France, takes you seriously when you are dressed like that. There will, of course, be some significant changes when a woman does become America's chief executive. That's the problem. Change scares people, especially people who have had it their own way for a long time, like men people.
Men have had a chance. So what's it going to take for a woman to win?
Well, yeah, women might need to start their own political party, you know, like the estrogen party or something, something that offers some semblance of. And it's not that women can't do the job or that they can't be tough enough to be president. It's just that we haven't really given them the chance. Americans are, we're snobs when we come to vote. We don't vote for fat people or bald people or people like that. Look how long it took us to have a black president. And so, yeah, I think it's time for women. Couldn't hurt.
Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. There's more at sltrib.com. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.